Well, shoot, it's a pleasure to be with you. Yeah. Typically, I talk about two things. I talk about the grocery business, and I talk about public education. Those are the two things I kind of know the most about or study quite a bit. But today, I thought I'd talk about something different. And I'll try to maybe talk for like 20 minutes and then maybe open up for questions. That sound okay? And I thought what I'd do is talk about three things that I wish I'd learned about earlier in my life that I found out about the hard way. I'm taking 20 of our up-and-coming managers, mid-level managers, through a faux MBA program at HEB right now. And it's really based off the premise that everything I've learned in college, now granted, I did go to USC, and I went to USC before you had to bribe your way in. And frankly, when I went there, you didn't have to be very smart. But all that aside, the things I use for my college education on a daily basis, really, I could write them on a 3x5 note card and carry them around in my shirt pocket. The practical things that I use, like the most important class I took in college was public speaking, because I use that every day. But if I ever have to use calculus again, HEB is in some big time trouble. I mean, that's all there is to it. And so we got to thinking about, like, there was no class on common sense in college, even though there probably should have been. So we thought for these 20 managers, what if we put together a curriculum that had the key points of an MBA that we distilled down into about 8 weeks and put them through that on a college campus. And then we put them through a number of other courses on things like storytelling and how to become a good storyteller, or things like persistence and resilience, because they don't teach you that. Like, what do you do when you have failure? And I'll talk a little bit about that this morning. And gave them some case studies, but built together this curriculum over the course of 18 months. And so I thought I'd just share with you a little bit of some of the things that we've included in that program that really have been an outpouring of experiences that myself and others have gone through that we wish we learned. And one of those, I guess the first one, would be to talk about values, because we all have them. But, you know, when you start to think about, as people get close to dying, that people will say, you know, I wish I'd lived a life where I'd been truer to myself and that I hadn't lived it for someone else. And frequently I'll hear, in particular, young people say, this whole work-life balance thing. You know, I'm working, but I, you know, I want more time to myself. And they tend to view it as as one or the other, an either or, instead of looking at it as an and also. Like, how do you cram as much living into your life as you possibly can? And so as a result, I think what happens for a lot of people is you end up saying one thing and then doing another. That you aren't necessarily true to yourself, or the term that I like to use is like, is there just one version of you? When you wake up in the day, are you the same person when you're with your wife, as you are when you're at work, as you are when you're at church, as you are when you're with the guys? One version of you. Because it makes it pretty easy to live your life. And so what if there was one authentic version of you? Well, it really starts with knowing who you are. And so if I ask most people, like, who are your three best friends, you'd tick them off and you probably never would say you as one of those three people. Now, I'm not necessarily saying, oh, become a narcissist and just, you know, be solely focused on you. But if I gave you like $1 million to invest, you would do some due diligence on the company that you would put money against. You wouldn't just, I remember my dad, when he was 80, he sold the family house. And so he ended up with this money because he'd had the house for 40 years. And so he calls me and he goes, I think I'm going to put the money into Compaq. My dad didn't even know what a computer was. And I'm like, Dad, don't do that, for heaven's sake. You're 80. Put it in a T-bill, for heaven's sakes. Right? You would do some due diligence around what it, and the same thing goes for you in terms of knowing who you are and having a clear picture of what purposes and values are most essential to you. Because if you don't know who you are and what's most important to you, then oftentimes you end up making decisions in response to other people, and you're going to end up being less fulfilled. You know, they talk a lot about the role of being a parent is that you instill values into your kids. And I've always thought that the role of parents is to help your kids make good decisions. I mean, you create a household where you set good examples, but I know for my own two daughters, when they were in middle school, that we would say to them, look, you're going to go to parties and you're going to go to events where you're going to be around other kids, and other kids are going to ask you to drink, and they're going to ask you to use drugs, and they may ask you to have sex, and we aren't going to be there to make that decision for you, and frankly, that's your decision, it's not ours. And so our request is that you give some thought in advance to who it is you want to be in that situation, so that you aren't reacting to at the spur of the moment and feel pressured to do any of those things. And then it's your decision. In other words, we wanted them to think about what their values were in regard to that situation before it happened. And so we tried to set up a situation where they thought about what their values were. And our lives are really guided by what our values are. And the problem is that we don't get clear about them, and that can result in our living our lives for somebody else. And that gets in the way of there being just one version of you. And when you get clear about what it is that's most important to you, it gets really easy to live into it. And I spent a lot of time just thinking about, over the last 3 years, what my values are and what's most important to me. So one of my values is integrity. Now, if I went through and said to you guys, like, so tell me about your values, a lot of people go, well, integrity. And so, but I've given some thought, like, why is integrity important to me? And here's why. When I was 16, I'd saved up enough money to buy an old Volkswagen, 1971 Volkswagen. But I didn't have enough money to put gas in it. So I went into my dad's bedroom and I took $3 out of his wallet. And then I went out and I was washing my car. What I didn't know was that my dad happened to count the money in his wallet every day. And so he came outside and he said, hey, could I borrow a couple bucks from you? And stupid me, I'm like, well, sure. And so I handed him his $3 back. At which point, he hit me upside of the head, and he looked at me and he said this, I'm not going to say anything to your mom because it'll disappoint her too much. And then he turned around and he walked into the house. And that was 42 years ago, and I can recite it verbatim. And I made a decision right then that I was never going to have my integrity brought into question ever again. I believe our values generally are formed by stories that have happened to us. And those stories don't normally revolve around that you won the spelling bee in the fourth grade, or that you were on the football team that won state. That most of those stories involve pain or loss or suffering that create these crucible moments in your lives. And a crucible moment is really defined as it's got to alter the way in which you see or you interpret a situation and the world and what your role in it is. And subsequently, your behavior is changed in accordance with this new and altered view. I mean, that's what happened to me with regard to integrity. Or values will come from an experience that you've been a witness to that's had a profound impact on others. So for instance, my friend Lisa Helfman, right there, is sitting here today. And I hired Lisa 5 years ago from Texas Children's Hospital to run real estate for us in Houston. And now she runs public affairs for HEB. Not only does she do that, she started a nonprofit. So her kids, she thought, well, maybe my kids could eat healthier. So she started having them eat fruits and vegetables. And they went to a birthday party. And her kids said, I don't want cake. I want fruits and vegetables. And she thought, well, we have this problem with obesity. What if I did this for low-income kids? And so she started working with the food bank now to where they deliver fruits and vegetables through the schools to low-income households. And last year, they delivered 32 million pounds of fruits and vegetables in Houston, Austin, Dallas, New York, Washington, D.C., Northern California, South Florida, all because of something she had a big vision for what she did. Anyway, I digress. So what Lisa told me about was something she started in her house with her boys around gratitude, and how it had a big impact in terms of how her sons kind of viewed the world and how they began to treat other people. And I thought, well, that's kind of interesting. So I spend about an hour every Monday morning writing notes to store leaders at HEB, congratulating them on their great sales or if someone has gotten promoted. And, you know, I'm thinking, well, I kind of do that. And Lisa explained to me, no, that wasn't gratitude. That was being thankful. And the distinction is that I was acknowledging people for what they did. I wasn't acknowledging people for who they were. So I tried it. I sent out three notes to people that I work with, letting them know how much I appreciated them and why? And I said to them things that I had felt, but that I'd never said. And I got to tell you, it felt really good to write it. Like, as I was writing, like, why didn't I ever do this before? And I had no idea the impact my note was going to have on others. So I began to write more notes. Like, I found addresses of teachers that I had in high school that had an impact on me, and I wrote to some old bosses that I'd had, and I sat down with my son-in-laws, and I talked to them. And the unplanned payoff on this was that the gift was actually to me because of how good I saw that I made others feel because I acknowledged them for who they were. And what it did was it reinforced who I wanted to be as a person as I read more and more about gratitude, and I saw that people who experience joy are those that experience gratitude. So those are a couple of different examples. I mean, integrity, for me, gratitude, optimism, championship, perseverance, curiosity. These are all different values that I've set and thought about, and once you understand what they are, it makes it pretty easy when I wake up in the morning to know who I am, regardless of where I am. And the big benefit for this, for me, is in terms of managing my time. Because when you aren't feeling obligated to do something for others, it becomes real easy to say no. Like, my wife will go, you know, I think we ought to go do this. No, that's not something I'm going to feel obligated to do, because in terms of my values, I know what I want to do because of who I am. And as a result, I live a fuller and a much more rich life. So I just say this. Take some time to think about what your values are and why, and once you know what it is that defines what makes you you, make it easy to live into that every day. And the other thing that we've done as part of this class is you find out that everybody's values are completely different. And that's what makes the world go round, and when you understand what other people's values are, you get a better peek into what makes them them, and it's not what makes you you. Okay, second thing. I said one of my values, curiosity. And if you think about life and how life kind of works is that you live your life divergently from a young age. So I've got four grandkids, and when they're little, they're wanting to stick their finger in the light socket. Every time they come over to the house, they open up drawers and they take everything out because they want to see what's in it. And then I didn't train my kids so well on this because they don't put everything back in. Then they go home, and then I put everything back in the drawer. But they're always, you know, taking things out. They take stuff apart all the time. They're just curious. And then when you get a little bit older, you want to play different sports. You know, you want to learn to play a musical instrument. You get ready to go to college, and you visit, like, a whole bunch of different colleges to see which one would be right for you. And then you think, you know, if I could have a semester abroad, then I could see how different people live, and wouldn't it be interesting to learn a different language? And then after you graduate, you think, well, if my parents would let me, if I could backpack around some country for 6 months, that would be so cool. And, you know, people who go too far think about how many places could I pierce on myself. It's all part of living this life that goes like this, right? And then you get married and you get a job and then you buy a house and you have kids and your life is still going like this. And you're curious about a whole bunch of stuff. And then someday this happens. Your life goes from living divergently to living convergently, and that's the day I think we start to die. And I got to tell you, that day scares me to death, and I fight it each and every day because I think part of our responsibility is to remain current, especially in the business world. At HEB, I mean, if you think about it, the top 10 retailers in 1995, only two of them still exist in their current form today. That's Walmart and Kroger. All the others, 3 through 10, have either been gone out of business or been bought by somebody else. And the reason why they were on the top of their game in 1995, but the customer changed, and they didn't. I mean, if you think about it, my dog will eat the same thing every day for the rest of her life and be happy. But if I give you tuna sandwiches 3 days in a row, you're pissed by the end of the third day, right? And so in 1995, we were putting Chinese kitchens in our stores, and they were a big hit. We didn't sell sushi. Today, I sell more sushi than I did bananas. So it's only by being curious have we been able to stay ahead of the curve, because look, Walmart is 17 times bigger than me, and Amazon is 45 times bigger than HEB. We're like David, they're like Goliath, and we have to be able to fight above our weight. And the way in which we do that is to sell stuff they don't, and that's around being curious. So I met with my friend Andrea White, Bill White's wife. I didn't meet with her. I was with her out to dinner, and she was telling me a few years ago about all the different books that she had read. Like, Andrea White's busy. She was working at the Chronicle. She's Bill White's wife. You know, I'd see her around town all the time. And I said, Andrea, how do you have time to read all these books that you're telling me about? She goes, oh, I don't read them. I listen to them. And I said, well, when do you have time to listen? She says, I listen to them in seams of time when I'm not doing anything else. Like when I'm in the car, I listen to them for 15 or 20 minutes, or when I'm on the treadmill. And she goes, so as a result, like I plow through a whole bunch of books. And it's because she's curious enough to find a way to make the time to stay curious. I mean, what a genius idea. So I started to do that. I read 20 books that year. The year before, I think I'd read two, not because I didn't want to. It's because I hadn't found a way to make time and found a way to channel my curiosity. I've got a guy who works with Lisa and me named Armando Perez. He's my number two guy. And he's the most curious guy I know, but he's always flipping me something from Twitter, which I'm on Twitter, and I mean, I don't look at it an hour a day, but he's like, we'll see something like, hey, have you seen this? Have you seen that? And some of it's business related, some of it's not business related, but when Armando and I go into a store, not an HEB store, but a competitor store, we will not leave until we find one good idea that we can steal. You know, when you go to college and you plagiarize, you get kicked out. When you get in the business world and you plagiarize, you get promoted. And I got a 40-year career of having done of that. So, you know, the whole idea on curiosity, I think one of our fears in life in general is that we become irrelevant. And the opposite of being curious is to become territorial. And maybe you've seen this at work, is that like you're going to implement some change and somebody fights it and they become territorial. And instead of being expansive of their thinking and in their thinking and thinking how they can add to, they try to protect what it is that they have. And at the center of being territorial is being judgmental of others. And this gets in the way of relationships and achieving results. And when you're curious and you take the time to learn and understand, you don't make assumptions and you operate with a clear picture of what reality is. So one of the big fundamental differences about HEB and Kroger and Randall's is that Kroger and Randall's operate from an assumption that all Americans eat the same. Now, we all eat hamburgers and pizza, but once you get beyond that, how people in Houston eat is different than how people in San Antonio eat. But if I took you to three Krogers in different cities around the United States, you would find that they merchandise their stores basically the same. I could take you to our store in West U and our store in Montrose, and I would show you significant differences in a store that is a mile and a half away in how we assort and how we merchandise those stores because the clientele is different. And then if I took you down to our Gulfgate store, which is I-45 and 610 South, because of the demographics and the income and the education levels, how people shop is distinctly different. And so as a result of that, we have to be curious about who's shopping in our store and why. Look, I'm a 62-year-old white guy, and by the grace of God, I can have for dinner tonight anything that I want. But we have a lot of our stores that service African-Americans who earn less than $30,000 per year. And so the only way that we can do an effective job of doing that is to stand in their shoes and get to know them. So we go into their homes with them, sit down and visit with them, look in their refrigerators, look in their cupboards, ask them what they had for dinner, so that we get a better picture of what we should put in our store. Because we know that they don't eat pizza and hamburgers every single day. Because if we assorted our stores the same in every single store, we would dust half the inventory and we'd be out of stock in half the inventory. And so what happens as a result of that is that people will talk about my HEB because their HEB is distinct to who they are. And so it's interesting. You don't hear people talk about my Starbucks. And I've never heard anybody say, oh, well, at my Mickey D's. But I do hear frequently people say, well, at my HEB, and nothing makes me prouder because of the effort that goes into it. We're getting ready to go into Lubbock. You know, I spent a month in Lubbock last Tuesday. And so what we did to go to Lubbock was over 5 days, actually I was there for a week, we sent a bus a day from San Antonio filled with our buyers. So we have a buyer who buys ground beef. We have a buyer who buys poultry. We have a buyer who buys milk. We have 210 buyers. So we sent a bus every day from San Antonio to Lubbock to go into our major competitors in Lubbock to understand why is Lubbock different, so that when we open up there, the store will be assorted correctly. And we think that's important in order to be relevant. Now, speaking of relevancy, I reported to my boss, same guy, for the last 14 years. And when I get my performance appraisal every year, I tell him the exact same thing. Thank you for the raise, but what's important to me is I want the ability to make a difference. And I think relevancy is a fundamental basic desire of everyone. Everybody wants to count, and at HEB it doesn't matter if you're an hourly partner, that's what we call our employees, or if you're me. I mean, everybody wants to be relevant, everybody wants to make a difference. And at HEB, we get a lot of credit for what we do at times of natural disasters. And so to make a point of that, I'll just give you a story of what happened in like the first hurricane that we really got known for this, and that was in 2005, and it was just after Hurricane Katrina hit in New Orleans. 2 weeks later, Hurricane Rita came barreling down on Beaumont, and I'd been here in Houston for about 2 years. I grew up in California, and I'd read about hurricanes, and I'd seen them on TV, but I'd never really gone through one. And so the eye of the hurricane passed right through Beaumont. I said to my number two guy at that time, I said, have you ever done a hurricane? He said, no. And I said, I mean, it was unconscious incompetence between the two of us to know what to do. Well, we had 9 stores in Beaumont, and they lost power, and the temperature outside was about 90 degrees, which isn't a good combination when you have a lot of perishable product in your store. FEMA, who had been heavily criticized after Katrina, said, we want everybody in the Golden Triangle, which I've always found that an interesting name for Beaumont, Port Arthur, and Orange. Like, I've never really found the gold part of that area. If you're from there, I apologize, but I digress. They wanted everybody to leave, but I mean, those Cajuns weren't going anywhere. They were staying put, and they were there, and I couldn't get my stores open, and so I was trying to see FEMA, and FEMA wouldn't see me, and so we had to do something. So we got 3 buses, and we filled them up with volunteers from up here in the Woodlands, and we got a Cadillac Escalade, and we got a blue light, flashing light, and we stuck it on top of the Cadillac Escalade, and I typed up a letter and said, to whom it may concern, these buses are authorized by me to enter the Golden Triangle area to clean up the HEB stores and get them ready to open. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, signed Scott McClellan, president of HEB, and they drive to Beaumont. And the police stop them and say, halt, you aren't allowed to come in here. And they said, oh, we've got a letter that allows us to come in. And they said, really? And they, now this might be a reflection on Beaumont, I don't know. They said, really? And so they look at the letter and they go, cool, come, we'll drive you to the store. And so we got the stores open like a week before Walmart did, and then we ordered ice from Arizona and Maryland because we couldn't get it local, then we just gave it away. But here's the real kicker in terms of what happened, was a lot of our people in the Triangle needed to work on their homes where it had been flooded out. So, and now we have 116,000 partners who work for us. At that time, we had about 80. And so we said, look, we need help. We need volunteers to come help get our stores open. Who will help? We need 2,000 volunteers. And so people volunteered 4 to a car, and they drove to Beaumont to help us get our stores open. And they slept wherever. They slept on people's floors. They slept on people's couches. They worked 15 hours a day. We paid them time and a half to do it. So it wasn't like they were getting rich to do it. They did it because they knew that they needed to, and they wanted to be relevant. And the payoff in this story was a year later, I was at a luncheon where we celebrated 20 and 25 and 30 and 35-year partners in their anniversary luncheons. And they always say, you know, what's been your most memorable time of working at HEB? And so many of them said, it was last year when I got to go to Houston and help them get the stores open because of the difference I made for the people who lived there. And that speaks about the importance of wanting to be relevant. And that really is our secret weapon that I think we have at HEB that our competition doesn't, is that when you frame what you do as a living as making your state better or your community better, then what you do is more than a job, because our partners knew that our communities needed help and they wanted to come and support. Third thing, final thing, was to talk about failure. And I wish someone had told me earlier in my career that it was okay to fail. And one of the big questions I pondered in my life is like, am I more motivated by the possibility of success or the absolute fear of failure? But the reality is that all of us are going to fail at some point in time in our lives, and most likely we're going to fail miserably. And when we do, it's painful. When you fall and you skin your knee, it hurts. A few years ago, I tore my Achilles tendon. Because I try to excel at everything I do, I tore my Achilles tendon 4 times and ended up having to have a transplant. And so I was in a boot or a cast or on crutches for about a year. And so I was this close to winning the sexy leg contest. And then that big scar came in on my leg, and a friend looked at my scar and he said, look, never be ashamed of a scar. It just says that you were stronger than what tried to hurt you. But not all scars are physical. The majority of scars that we have in our life are disappointments or setbacks, and they tend to be more mental. And by now, I've come to realize that in life, that my greatest growth and learnings that I have come from the times that I was confronted by setbacks and failure. Hope is a function of struggle. And those with the highest level of hope are those who probably have had the greatest experience with setbacks. I had a good friend here in Houston who was a Holocaust survivor. Her name was Naomi Warren, and in the Holocaust, she lost her husband and her mother and her sister-in-law and other family members during the concentration camps during World War II. She told me at one point in time in the concentration camp that she walked by a window and she looked in and she saw a reflection, and she didn't recognize who she saw, and then she realized it was her, and she was just that thin. She survived, and she emigrated to the United States with her father, and I was having dinner with her one night. And she told me, and I came home and I wrote this in my journal right away because I found it so amazing. She said, the Holocaust made me a better person. And I remember when she said it, just turning and looking like, what an amazing thing to say. But she went on to say that she was raised spoiled and self-absorbed, and that the Holocaust made her both tougher and more empathetic. And when she sailed into New York City and saw the Statue of Liberty, she made a decision that while she wasn't going to forget her past, she wasn't going to let it define who she was. And she went on to own and operate one of the finest processed meat companies. It's called ITC. And that company is the only company that has won our highest quality award ever at HEB. Now, her sister-in-law was in the same camp with Naomi. And they were awoken every morning before dawn and then had to go and do big-time manual labor. And one time her sister-in-law said, look, I can't do it this morning. And Naomi said, you've got to, because if you don't get up, they're going to kill you. And she said she was too tired. She wouldn't get up. And she told her, look, if you don't, you won't be here when I get back. She didn't get up. She never saw her again. Look, we all face disappointments in our lives and when things don't go the way in which we want. And there are three fundamental reactions to disappointment that we can have. We can quit, we can pout, or we can dust ourselves off and we can get back into play. And quitting is a viable option. Like, look, this didn't work out. I think I'm going to go do something else. And dusting yourself off certainly is a viable option. Like, okay, I'll do the best I can. But oftentimes you see people sulk and pout. And that's never a good option in terms of how I can see it. And so, you know, if you think about life, we're all dented cans. And generally, we're just trying to do the best that we can. And when we're young, our parents say this to us, look, you're going to learn from your mistakes. And when my parents told me that, I didn't believe them. But as usual, in the end, they were right. I just wish now that they were still alive so that I could write them a letter of gratitude. Thank you very much.